Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Michelangelo Signorelli is our guest, one of the best names I've heard in many a year. What a name, huh? He's the author of It's Not Over, Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality. He is also the best-selling author of Queer in America. He hosts the Michelangelo Signorelli show on Sirius. And he is editor-at-large of the Huffington Post's Gay Voices Vertical. He's written for the New York Times, LA Times, The Advocate, and The Village Voice. And he writes that, you know, with the recent Supreme Court decision on same-sex marriage, there is a sense of victory in the air. But at the same time, there are so many states that do not protect LGBT people from discrimination. He writes in the book, very troubling cases of discrimination. The closet remains deeply entrenched in America, particularly in southern states. When you hear about Mississippi, I think you'll be astounded. Bullying and family rejection is still very much present in America. And so he lays out a plan of how to win true equality. And we will talk about that as well during the course of this hour. For your phone calls, our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Michelangelo, what a name. Aren't you glad your parents gave you that name?
Well, now I am. I was a kid.
You weren't? Oh, you weren't? You were carrying around a lot, I know. But if you could give the whole history, yes, I'm Michelangelo because I am this great artist. Da-da-da-da. It's just a great name, at any rate.
Yeah.
All right, so there's been all this.
It was my grandfather's name.
Oh.
And I had to sort of carry it around and being called all kinds of different things. You could imagine how the kids twisted it around. But now I love it.
Good. I'm glad you do. I love it, too. All right. So there's this great sense of victory in the air, particularly the last couple of weeks with the Supreme Court decision, same-sex marriage. We're already seeing a little bit of backlash. But you do remind us in a sobering fashion that there are a lot of problems around still, aren't there? The true equality simply is not with us.
You know, every movement has these moments of triumph and victory, and this is certainly one, and we should be celebrating. And we've had others in the past, and certainly every other movement has had them. But they are moments that, you know, sometimes are dangerous in a sense because people believe or want to believe, particularly after being cast out for so long and so mistreated, they want to believe that, hey, maybe it's done now. Maybe, you know, the work is finished, and they become intoxicated by the wins. And the truth is that we still have many states, more than half the states, with no protections for LGBT people. So now people can get married in every state, but in some of those states, they can be thrown out of their homes or thrown out of their job or turned away from an establishment, and it's perfectly legal. And there are no federal protections as well. And then, you know, I talk a lot in the book about just the cultural changes that need to happen as well. The fact that we still even have to talk about coming out,
yes,
when we shouldn't even be raising children in the closet. I mean, that's going to be an enormous thing to try to change.
Mm-hmm. And you write some statistics. I really wasn't aware of them, Michelangelo. How many people are still in the closet, particularly in conservative states in the South, particularly in this country, people who are leading lives that are not very truthful because they have to. Or they feel they
have to. It's interesting. It's very interesting how we now are able to really gather so much information by using the internet because people put so much out there. And I spoke to a Google data scientist, Seth Davidowitz, who had done all of this work looking at the closet and looking at how many gay men specifically were out in different states. And he used Facebook searches and Facebook profiles and Google searches and Craigslist ads and Match.com and all of these various data sets to really show how the closet is really entrenched, where you know, on Facebook, just a little bit over half of gay men would identify themselves as gay, and how he pretty much was able to chart that in every state there's the same percentage of gay people. This idea that people move to San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, yes, there's some movement, but actually not as much as people think. People do stay in terms of the numbers evening out all across the country. Probably 5% or so of the population are gay men, but the percentage of closeted people is much higher in the southern states. And he was able to look at how, for example, in New York State, more men are using Match.com who are openly gay, looking for relationships and, you know, open and out and looking for dating. But in Mississippi, more men are using Craigslist to have sex and meet men covertly, and often they're married to women and still living in the closet. And he was able to deduce through all of these different data sets that, you know, as I said, an average across the country, little over half of people may be out of the closet, but in Mississippi, 80% of gay men, he deduced, were still closeted and are still living, you know, in a very secretive way, and many of them married to women. He also had looked at Google searches, and the number one Google search for women doing a search about their husband is my husband gay? It's higher than is my husband cheating or is my husband having an affair? And the highest number of those searches are, I think South Carolina is number one, and then Louisiana, and then Alabama, and then Mississippi. So it's very interesting. When you put all the data sets together, you're able to look at a picture.
Right. Well, they're still finding the Confederate flag and our steeped in their cultural history in many places in the South, right?
Even though
it ended 150 years ago. But some of these others are this bullying and family rejection. LGBT youth, you write, 10% of all teens, but accounting for 30 to 40% of teen suicides. We have to be able to achieve a country where people do not worry about being LGBT when they're young, that they have a life, that they should be accepted for the whole of their lives. Those statistics just bring tears to your eyes. They're horrible.
Yes, and, you know, the fact that we have marriage equality is great, and it's great for people who are of age and can get married, and it will be great for future generations to be able to see that that is a reality. But right now, and I think for a long time, we still have kids who are growing up in families that do not accept them for being gay or transgender. We had a horrible case just in December that played out of a transgender teen, Leela Alcorn, who took her life. But before she did, she posted on her blog her suicide note and said that her parents took her to these conversion therapy programs and the Christian therapy programs, and it really showed how even in this time when we're all celebrating, these stories are still happening. Of course, we've seen story after story of teens taking their lives, and we also see a very similar statistic when it comes to homeless youth. Again, LGBT youth make up at most, you know, 10%, and that's probably being generous, of the population, but they account for 40% of homeless LGBT youth. And, in fact, the progress may even be exacerbating that problem in a sense, because in the year that New York passed marriage equality in 2011, in New York City, they actually saw a surge of one of the LGBT homeless groups that takes care of the kids on the streets saw a surge of 40% increase that year in kids on the street. So you have to wonder, you know, do kids see all this progress and then they say, I'm going to come out because We now see the average age of people coming out of the closet is, I think from 20 years ago, it was something like 21, and now it's something like 13. So kids are coming out younger. They're seeing all of this victory on TV and elsewhere. But then many of them are being rejected by their parents, some of them being thrown out of their homes, some of them facing bullying, some of them, you know, taking their lives. So that is a reality that even with all of these victories, we still have to be very much aware.
Yes. And you write in your book, you do a radio show, so you hear from people all over the country who are facing acts of discrimination and worse on a daily basis, slights or beatings or violence. And there are many instances of that early on in your book. And there, we're talking about 2011, 2014, not very long ago at all, just, you know, a few months ago in some cases.
Oh, yeah. Whenever I talk about, even now, whenever I talk about any case of discrimination, people will call and share their own stories, being told that, you know, they're not welcome at a certain restaurant, being told that they're not served, or, you know, being told they're too strange for the customers, they don't like them, they want them to leave. People have told me stories of being fired from their jobs. Every time I talk about a case of discrimination, people call up and talk about that. There's the story of the young man who was working in a foster home, and he took all of the kids in Texas, took all of the kids out for an outing to the supermarket, and he introduced them to his fiance, who was a man, and he came back and he was fired because the head of the agency said, we cannot have this kind of influence on the children. That happens all the time in Texas and Alabama, in 29 states where there are no protections.
So was the same-sex marriage fight, which was so successful, so organized, so well done, and got progress in a fairly rapid process, was it the wrong focus? Should the focus have been anti-discrimination laws, federal laws?
I don't think it's the wrong focus, or was the wrong focus for the movement and people who really wanted to get that right for themselves and were part of the grassroots of the movement. I think that was sort of where the energy was, and you have to go where the movement is going. There were people in states where they did have protections already. Hawaii was the place where really a lot of the marriage movement really started, the modern marriage movement 20 years ago, and they were being treated well in their state, and they said, we want to fight for marriage. And it became something that people in other states said, yeah, we want to do that too. And I think it benefits all of us because it will help in this larger fight in a dramatic way to get protections in job and housing and public accommodation as well, because now we've won this other major right. You know, it could have gone the other way, and then we would get marriage. But I think once you just take, you know, make one of these milestones, it's going to help in the fight for everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And it does set the standard for gay people being treated equally.
Mm. I'm always amazed every time there's a horrendous event which has to do with race in this country, as there was just at the end of June in Charleston, South Carolina, that suddenly we have to remember our history. And for the first time, people hearing that, oh, black churches were burned down and have been burned down. This very same church was burned down in the 1800s. We have to learn about slavery all over again. It seems as though that is not a part of our history textbooks. And when you think about LGBT history being taught in schools, I'll bet it's virtually non-existent.
Well, I talk a lot about that in the book, and talk about how we need to. One of the things we need to do at the, you know, at the end of the book, I have a whole bunch of things in the epilogue charting a path forward that we need to do, and one of them is to take the lead from California. It's the only state that has mandated, and it just started this year, teaching of the history and the contributions of LGBT people in this country and of prominent LGBT people in history. And it took quite a battle there. It was quite a battle there. It took several years. The textbooks are finally coming out. But in just a few districts where they were doing it already, they had done a study and they showed that it dramatically had decreased bullying and had really done an enormous amount just to educate all of the kids about LGBT people, and was really something that was very positive. And so this is what we have to get done, you know, nationally in every state. And, of course, we have a bunch of states where we have laws that say you're not allowed to even talk about sexual orientation in the classroom. So, again, another very big thing we need to do. But, you know, when I look at marriage and look at what we were able to do with that by focusing so intently on that issue, and people thought it was crazy, how are you ever going to do that? I think that when we look at these other things, as daunting as they are, we can do it.
Yeah. And when you look at where the demographics are, obviously the same-sex marriage population that really was huge numbers in favor of that, it was the younger generation.
That's right. Things have shifted really quite quickly on that issue. When you go back to just 2004, and George W. Bush was using it as something to actually galvanize people to come out and vote, and you had even, you know, majorities of Democrats who in many of the states were opposed to marriage equality. When you look at how quickly it changed, you see that a lot of that change happened because of the next generation that came up and just was much more, accepting, and just really didn't think it was an issue at all. And that is something that I think bodes very well for the movement moving forward on all of these other issues.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Michelangelo Signorelli is our guest this hour. His latest book, It's Not Over, Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality. Our number is 800-486-8655. Those of you who are in the LGBT community, you probably have stories of discrimination to share with us as well. Should we be teaching LGBT history in all of our schools? Would it keep young people from being afraid to come out of the closet? And I thought Michelangelo made an interesting point. When are we going to reach a time when that phrase, coming out of the closet, will be a weird thing to even think about, because it'll just be part of who human beings are, that some people are LGBT and some are not, and that we're accepting of each other, so we don't need terms like that. We are welcoming your phone calls. Do we need federal legislation, anti-discrimination legislation? His book is filled with stories that will raise many eyebrows, that you can't believe that this is happening in 2015 and was happening at the end of 2014. But due to a lack of anti-discrimination laws, it still is happening, even though it's not to discount the huge victories that have been taking place as well. So let's go to you. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can leave messages there or go to Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Michelangelo. Sarah in Zion, hi.
Hi there. I started working as a substitute teacher this year in an elementary school, and I'm totally new at it. And so I really didn't know how to handle things at first when they came up, and I just had to learn how. And one of the things was when I hear people calling you, because when they say, oh, you're gay, you just hear people say that all the time. And I would just say, no, don't call names, that's mean. But I wouldn't go further than that. But this one day was either third or fourth grade, and the kids were doing some sort of independent, they were like group activity where they were walking around the room talking. And all of a sudden, this, like three kids came up to me and they said, oh my God, so-and-so and so-and-so just kissed each other, you know, these two boys. And they were just looking at me like, what are you going to do about it? And I thought, okay, here's the moment. And what am I going to do? And I just decided, you know, I just have to go for it. This is, I have to tell the truth. And I said, and I was worried a little because it's conservative district, but I said, okay, kids, listen, I have something to say. If two boys want to kiss each other, it's okay. All right? You shouldn't do it at school because there's no kissing in school, but if two boys want to kiss each other, it's fine. And there was like half a second of silence where they just sort of seemed to think about that. And then they just were like, okay, and they just went back to doing their thing. End of story. It was like, all right, it's cool. And that was like a great day for me. I really enjoyed that.
Michelangelo.
That really is wonderful, and you handled it really beautifully because you were explaining to them there was nothing wrong with this, while at the same time, obviously, drawing the boundaries of what's appropriate in school in terms of, you know, what kids, whether they're straight, gay, you know, should be doing in terms of intimacy, but really explaining to them that there was nothing wrong here. I mean, you could have simply stopped them and, you know, based it on the fact that this was inappropriate in school, but it would have sent a message to the other kids that was wrong to do. And I really commend you for doing what you did.
Thanks so much. And yet you also highlight some kind of bullying, and more than that, people who are openly open about their displays of infection, even in New York City or some places, and maybe you have to be careful about that now, or do you, because you risk the wrath of some bigots who are looking at you and decide to hit you?
Well, it's the one thing that still, even many people who support gay rights are very uncomfortable about. When Michael Sam, the football player, first openly gay player, kissed his boyfriend on national television when he was named to the NFL when he was drafted, just as all the other players kissed their girlfriends, and there was such an uproar in the media, including from a lot of people who are very accepting. I write about how I went on CNN the next day, and I was asked, you know, well, doesn't he have to worry about what's going to happen when he walks in the locker room, and they're all going to know that they're all going to have seen that kiss? And I mean, I'm not sure what the idea was that, you know, they were afraid he was going to kiss them, or I don't know, but it's the one thing that I think we still, you know, every day on television we see heterosexuals kissing and doing a lot more, but it's the one thing you still don't see as much. We're starting to see more of it on television, and that's a good thing. But that's, I think, why it's important for people to basically desensitize people by being open and being who they are. But nonetheless, you know, even in New York City, I think you'll see a lot of people afraid who are gay or lesbian, particularly in certain neighborhoods where they might not feel safe because they feel like they'll be attacked or yelled at or face some sort of violent, you know, I faced it literally in my neighborhood that's a gay neighborhood. My husband passed me on the street as we were both running errands, and we chatted, and then we did a quick kiss that, I mean, would have been in Europe, it would have just been two straight men, you know.
Right.
a man walked by and called us disgusting. So you still see it every day, and nonetheless, you have to do it. And we stood up to him, and you know, he heard a mouthful. But
oh, really?
You have to.
You're not known for that, are you?
Well. And that's another thing, you know, when you can do it, certainly people should not put themselves in danger, but I think too many times we all just, you know, overlook these situations. We internalize them. Mm-hmm. We don't stand up to them. We have to stand up for ourselves and speak out when we can.
Let's go to Owen. Thank you, Sarah, for your call. Owen in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thanks.
Sure.
So I'm a member of the Wisconsin Transgender Health Coalition. And just wanted to mention that I feel like in these conversations, oftentimes we're hearing from white folks and we're hearing from gay and lesbian people, and we're not really looking at the transgender community as a whole, or looking at people of color and looking at kind of how those intersections of identity impact people's experiences. And I just wanted to share briefly from this grassroots coalition, what we found by doing surveys and focus groups across Wisconsin as far as what the priorities are within the transgender community that we feel like needs to be kind of worked on to make our lives better. And the four priorities we found over the course of 2 years was racial justice, non-discrimination policies, competent healthcare and mental health providers that actually know how to serve transgender people, and ending violence against trans people. So those kind of four priorities are what we found from conversations across Wisconsin, and we're hoping to move forward to kind of make sure that folks who are trans are feeling like they have access to resources and support so that this violence and the suicides that you all talked about before can be lessened in our community.
Yeah, it's such an important issue that we need to educate both inside the LGBT community as well as outside. I talk a lot in the book about the violence that plays out threefold against transgender women and transgender women of color being the hardest hit group when it comes to this violence on the streets. And it's part of what I was talking about earlier. When you have this backlash, you have something like marriage equality, and the backlash plays out on the most vulnerable groups, which in this case are transgender women of color. And it doesn't get the attention that it should. And so we need to obviously focus on that, as well as focus on, when we're talking about LGBT youth and homeless youth, again, the majority Latino and African American and transgender youth as well. This is an issue that I think is the priority moving forward as well, in terms of federal legislation and making sure people have access to medical care in terms of transitioning if they are experiencing gender dysphoria and need hormone treatment as well. All of these issues need to be a priority. What I do want to make sure all transgender people know, though, because a lot of times it's not talked about, is that there was a big victory for transgender people at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and it basically really was a win for transgender people when it comes to employment, because now Title VII of the Civil Rights Act has been defined as protecting transgender people, because it does protect on the basis of gender, on the basis of sex, and that is something people should know, because they can file a lawsuit federally. Gays and lesbians aren't protected, at least at this point, under federal law, but the EEOC ruling ruled that transgender people are protected in employment in every state, and that is something they need to know so they can file a suit when something happens.
You also, the caller mentioned health care. You also write in your book about health care and about the number of gay men, particularly, who go to a health care provider and don't let the person know about their sexuality. And as a result, there may not be an HIV test, which might be an important thing to do, or, you know, a whole host of issues that are gender specific in some ways too, that have to do with who we are. That's pretty amazing that people don't feel comfortable in their healthcare setting to talk about who they are.
Well, I think it does show you again how people are so afraid of coming out. Where gay men, more than half of gay men, had not told their doctors that they were gay. And a similar number had not been told by their doctor that they needed to have an HIV test. And for transgender people, it's even larger. There's a real fear of how a doctor will treat them. And it's so important for people to be able to find healthcare professionals who accept them and understand them, rather than simply, going, sort of staying in the closet about it. And what it does do, ultimately, is drive people away from even getting healthcare. So we see, there was a study recently about a lot of adverse effects of simply being gay or transgender, because people don't even go into the healthcare system. They're afraid of it. On the HIV front, we still see infection rates among gay men and transgender women that are the same as what they were 20 years ago. We still had an enormous problem with HIV prevention and with getting people access to prevention because we don't have education nationally, even from the federal health establishment, that's very explicit about HIV. So there's still an enormous amount that needs to be done when it comes to both HIV and general health care.
Thank you, Owen, so much for your call. Alan in Milwaukee. Hi.
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 I've got an extremely short comment and two good questions. The comment is there is a docudrama trilogy running on Showtime. I saw it last night. So, and that's going to be running for quite a while.
What's the name of it? It's called Trilogy?
No, no. A docudrama trilogy.
Okay.
I don't remember the name of it. I just remember that it begins with an S, as in Susan, but I don't remember the name of it. Second thing I want to say is congratulations on yet one more of an endless line of Kathleen Dunn outstanding shows. This one ought to win an award, if there ever was one. Next item. One of the themes espoused by the institution that produced the docudrama is, let's get the T out of LGBT. It doesn't belong with LG and B. It's its own group, its own cluster of people. So I'd like to know what your guest thinks about that. And last, my last question is, aren't there really many different kinds of transgender people? And unless you've already addressed that, and I tried to catch the show from the beginning, I would like to know what are all the different types of transgender people?
Thanks for the call, Ellen. Michelangelo.
Well, to the question about LGBT, these are all very different identities with their own histories and culture, and certainly we need to focus on those distinctions. But we have commonalities that have a historical connection, and we have been a movement that has focused on those commonalities for a very long time. And you know, at the very beginning, we didn't have all of these letters because everybody was gay. And then lesbians said, "Hey, wait a minute, we're being invisible here." And bisexual people said, "We're invisible." And transgender people said, "Hey, wait a minute, we're invisible." So there are very different things, and I think what he was referring to, the caller, were, you know, we have to focus on the specifics of what are the problems, certainly, that transgender people face, what are the issues they face that are distinct from gay men, from lesbians. But I think that we are all together in the same group because of the common type of discrimination we face. Whether you're an effeminate gay man or a transgender woman, a gay basher doesn't care. They're going to beat you up on the street or attack you. You know, we face very similar oppression, and I think we have to move forward as a movement in that regard. We are, you know, much more powerful if we are all together. The second part of his question, what was that?
Oh, the second part of his question was the different types of transgender.
I'm glad, because it's very, very important too, and people really need to educate themselves about transgender identity, and there are authors they should be reading and books they should be reading, and I refer to a lot of them in my book as well, because the transgender experience is not one that is very uniform. There are all different types of people on a spectrum. You know, obviously there are transgender women, there are transgender men, there are people who see themselves as not one gender or the other gender. There are people who call themselves genderqueer. They have very different experiences. Not all transgender people are seeking surgery or experience gender dysphoria and having hormone treatment. Other people are. There are very, very different types of experiences of it, and people need to educate themselves about it.
Could we talk a little bit about the religious liberty, the religious freedom movement that seemed to gain national prominence in Indiana and a backlash against that movement as well? Do you see it growing among the states as a result of the Supreme Court decision, Michelangelo?
I think we are going to see more of an effort in that regard. And what I really, you know, have been very vocal about with people when it comes to what happened in Indiana or even Arizona last year is we get swept up in these moments where the media focuses intently on an issue, and big business comes out, and you know, we have corporations saying, no, we're not going to accept that, and that's all great. What happened in Indiana was great, but we sort of always, again, convince ourselves that we've passed a turning point. It can't happen again, and what happens is, you know, the enemies of equality for LGBT people, they rely on the media not paying attention the next time, doing it more under the radar, rewording. They retool these bills. They reword them. You know, in 2014, Arizona tried to pass one of these bills. It was a similar uproar as we saw in Indiana. And the Super Bowl was even threatened. The NFL was threatening to pull out the Super Bowl, so the governor didn't sign the bill, Jan Brewer. And everybody thought, wow, nobody will try this again. And then a few months later, they got a bill passed in Mississippi. They worded it a little bit differently, but it really was exactly the same. The media wasn't paying attention. There wasn't the kind of big business in Mississippi that would speak out, and they got it passed. Indiana and Arkansas, you know, were another example where people thought, wow, we finally beat that back. And then literally months later, North Carolina passed a law that allows officials to opt out of performing marriages for gay and lesbian couples. This was before the Supreme Court ruling. And Michigan passed a law that allows state-funded adoption agencies to deny gay and lesbian couples of services. And again, it got no attention in the media. So they are happening. Your question was, are we going to see more of these things? They are happening. They retool them, they reword them, and they rely on people not paying attention and the media not paying attention. And we have to really pay attention to make sure that they get beaten back.
We go next. Thanks, Alan, for the call. Eric in Niagara. Hi.
Hi there. Yeah, I just had a quick question for you. First off, I'd like to know, you know, you keep talking about progress in a movement that's taking place. I was just curious on if the straight community, being a father myself of a boy and a girl, what you think about that. You know, was the straight community kind of in the foreground? Were they thought about, you know, were they just kind of pushed aside for this to be, you know, kind of pushed through for everyone, which, I got to say, I think it's great anytime there's any kind of, you know, advancement in civil rights. I think it's a great thing, you know. However, I think everybody knows any movement, when you have that big tidal push, you know, you still have to wait for all the ripples to kind of catch up. And I was just kind of curious, you know, for one, what are maybe the ripples from this, or what are maybe some of the consequences that, you know, lesbian, gay, et cetera, will have, as well as straight people that were maybe taken into consideration when all this was being pushed forward. And I'll take my question off here.
Okay.
I'm not sure exactly what he means by consequences. I don't think there are any consequences that are negative, certainly. But what I do hope happens is that people raise their children, straight people raise their children with the idea that there's a possibility that children are gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender, that they don't immediately assume that their children are heterosexual or are, you know, the gender they were assigned at birth, because that's where you start that closet, and our whole culture is completely oriented around it. We buy pink things for the girl and we buy blue things for the boy, right, from the moment they're born. And that's where we start those closets. That's where we're assigning those children roles and telling them, we then tell the boys they have to play baseball and they have to do this and they have to do that and they have to be this way and they're going to get married and they're going to have be a dad and they're going to have a wife. And we don't give those kids any space for how they're going to be. Your kids are going to be what they're going to be. There's nothing you can do to change that. So why not just allow kids to grow in their own way and find themselves and not force them into that class? That's what I hope will be a positive consequence of all of this.
And do you think that it will, and that it will take some time for that to happen, because that would be ideal for everybody eventually?
I think it really can happen. I think it's going to be a long time. And the last chapter of my book really looks at the world of sports and how we have to break down. That's where it all happens, in the world of male team sports, where you have this masculinity that's defined in a certain way, and where there's a lot of homophobia, and it you know, kind of is something that, you know, begins in schools, in the sports programs, and in the way that we, you know, create that delineation. And I think we really have to begin breaking that down. But that's about getting, as I said earlier, into the issue of education in schools and changing how we talk about these issues.
I know you write about commentators, homophobic remarks, etc. I don't watch a lot of those sports talk shows, but is that still the mainstay for a lot of those programs, or have we moved beyond that?
No, we still see on many of the networks, CNN and elsewhere, the issue of gay rights held up as one with two sides, where there is, you know, this other side that believes it's wrong. Now, you know, if there's I'm certainly not saying there should be censorship. If there's a real debate about an issue, bring on real experts, scientists or analysts, political analysts who will talk about the politics. But when they simply bring on a religious conservative who, you know, has no, you know, expertise on the issue in terms of how there will be harm or you know, danger to anybody, to me, that's still allowing for the bigotry. At a certain point, the debate has to end. We don't bring white supremacists on television to debate issues regarding race anymore, or anti-Semites, you know, to debate the Holocaust. There are just certain things where you have to say, okay, that debate is over. Now, again, does that mean you don't bring people on who discuss policy or who are scientists and experts in these fields? Of course not. But we have to get past this both sides, you know, delusion, and then have these religious conservatives brought on.
More phone calls in just one moment. This hour, our guest is the author of It's Not Over, Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality. Michelangelo Signorelli is our guest. He is also the author of Queer in America. He hosts the Michelangelo Signorini show on Sirius, and he's editor-at-large of the Huffington Post's Gay Voices Vertical. He's an award-winning journalist, has written for the New York Times, LA Times, New York, The Advocate, Village Voice, and we're welcoming phone calls. The idea of the book, and there is a lot of detail about discrimination that gay and lesbian and bisexual and transgendered people have still been facing, religious liberty response to same-sex marriage decisions in many states in the country, whether or not we need federal anti-discrimination laws. Should we be teaching, as California had just started doing, what do you think about that, LGBT history in our schools? Our number is 800-486-8655, or you can leave messages on our Facebook page. We're getting close to running out of time, so call right now. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, let's go to more phone calls for Michelangelo. Andrew in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I wanted to tell a story about a friend of mine. He's a trans man. He transitioned about 2 or 3 years ago. At that time, he was a full-time employee working at a warehouse. By all accounts, he was a fantastic employee. When he came out as trans, everybody there was overtly very accepting. But as he started to transition, he started to get pushback in these subtle ways. Like, he was basically being gaslighted. For example, they would give him instructions. He would follow through the instructions. And when he would come back, they would act like they had told him to do something different, stuff like that. And eventually, it got so bad that he had to quit. So I think it's just important to remember that not everybody is fired explicitly for their sexual orientation or gender identity. A lot of the times it's a more subtle pushback.
It is so true. You can have protections, and, you know, we see this, of course, even with people with regard to race, or even women experiencing it, too, even with laws protecting them. You still see the ways that people are pushed out, and it is based on those categories. And in Wisconsin, there is a law that bans discrimination based on sexual orientation, but transgender people still face a lot of legal issues that people who aren't transgender face as well. And as the caller said, even when there are protections, or when people are not told blatantly that they are being fired because they're gay or transgender, they are pushed out, ostracized in other ways. And there's only so much the laws can do, right? That's why we have to change the culture. That's why we have to change what's going on in the schools. That's why we have to change the media. That's why we have to change the entertainment industry, too. I talk a lot about that in the book, too. Mm-hmm. There's just so much invisibility in our popular culture as well. Or there are images that are just very bland and safe, like, you know, Modern Family, two white gay men who don't really have any chemistry between them and are kind of like safe for people. We have to change all of our culture because the laws aren't enough.
Thanks, Andrew, for your call. Jake in Oshkosh, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, great show. Two quick comments. The teacher who called in about the two boys kissing, she better be careful if she teaches in a parochial Catholic or evangelical school, because her answer would have gotten her fired. And two, the history you were talking about, LGBT history, being taught in schools, They need to teach about the persecution of the LGBT people, like Gay Edgar Hoover and the FBI.
Yeah.
Sitting just tormented those people for years and years and years. And my question is, since the Supreme Court case about same-sex marriage, has there been anything done about studying same-sex divorce and all the ramifications with regards to that?
Well, there actually have been a couple of cases already that, were kind of ridiculous in a way, because a couple tried to get divorced in Texas, and Texas wouldn't divorce them because they felt that if they divorced them, they'd have to be recognizing gay marriage. So they refused to divorce them, and it was sort of incumbent on people to go back to the state where they were married to actually get a divorce. Now that there's marriage for everyone, whether they're gay or straight, there's divorce for everyone, whether they're gay or straight. So I think that the Supreme Court solved that problem with the marriage decision.
And I'm wondering, Michelangelo, is there, if you, and you might take issue with this, but let's just say that anti-discrimination laws, most people would agree, are really front and center, that they would take care of some of the many problems that the LGBT community and people who believe in equality are still facing. Is there a movement that's anywhere near as organized as the same-sex marriage movement, which was really, really good in moving this through in a very deliberate fashion and speedy fashion? Is there such a movement for anti-discrimination laws?
I think there will be now. I think people will focus more. You know, we had a very narrow bill. Gay leaders were taking this strategy of asking for very little, a very narrow bill, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would just ban discrimination in employment, and then it had religious exemption that would basically exempt all of every institution that would be discriminating. So it was very narrow, and they thought that was the way to go, that you have to be, you know, very, you know, you have to sort of ask for little crumbs, and I think what we showed with marriage equality was no. Ask for something big and bold, and,
yeah,
and
look what happened.
Then you'll get it. Yeah, so
thank
now
you.
There is a bill. There is a bill in Congress that's a full, comprehensive bill.
All right. Thank you, Michelangelo. Your book is very, very well done, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Michelangelo Signorilli, It's Not Over, Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and Winning True Equality. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers. We'll talk about all things political Monday at 1:00.